sound set.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
Twitter IPOs. Tesla is tapping support. The jobs number defies all odds, and guest Clint Coons, attorney, is going to talk to us a little bit about how to set yourself up as a trader. All this and much more on episode number 338 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Well, hello. How are you? Can't get that song out of my head. I saw the show last week in New York. The Book of Mormon. Have you seen that? It's kind of funny. Pokes a little fun, or a lot of fun, at the religion, but I think it really had to do with all religions, all groupthink and all, and it was very interesting how it was put together. I think it was distasteful if you took it very seriously, and it was really funny if you took it just as a laugh at yourself, I guess. But great show. Very expensive, but a great show. And there was a song that started out with Hello, you know, the ringing the doorbells, riding around the streets with and their bicycles, talking about how, you know, the religion is great for you and all that. Anyway, Andrew Horowitz here. Thanks again for being with me. I have a long list of things to talk about today, and I want to just first of all say thanks again, always, for your emails. I get quite a bit of emails from you, and it is great because it makes me feel as if this is a two-way conversation, not just me talking to you and you listening, and just like you would on a television show or maybe, I don't know, the radio, where you kind of have to just listen to what they say and go along with it. This is an interactive process, and that's what's beautiful about it. So if you do want to send me an email, send it over to askandrew@thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Where do I begin? Do we start with Twitter? Do we start with Tesla? Jobs numbers on Friday? I guess we'll go in order. Where to start? All right, so Twitter's IPO. Now, Twitter IPO, do you know that this week there was a lot of talk, a lot of discussion and media attention, and there was just an incredible amount of stir about this because the big question of the day was, are we going to see another catastrophe like we saw with Facebook? You know, the big problems that plagued the NASDAQ on the offering, the technical problems that happened, plus the mismanagement of the overall process on the IPO, and there was a lot of testing done. There was a lot of commentary from the New York Stock Exchange saying, hey, you know what? We're ready. We did all this great stuff, and here we go. Now, let's talk a little bit about what happened. So the stock opens up at about, let's call it 46, 47 or so, 48. This is after the IPO priced at 26. So a very nice opening for the stock, right? No question about that. Now, here's a couple of things. This was sent to me by a colleague. I want to share this with you, okay? There was 28 million shares to buy on the open. Okay, now, Knight Capital was looking to buy about 8 million at the market, probably retail, and there was a gray market putting it about 43 million at the putting the price at about 43 at the open because it was so much of a desire to get in there. 10 institutional investors got 50% of the allocation, and the IPO was 30 times oversubscribed. Now, here's what's really interesting. The top 30 accounts got 75% of the deal, probably all mutual funds, and maybe there wouldn't be a lot of flipping there, maybe not a lot of selling there, whereas the Facebook went almost 50% to retail. Interesting, right? Now, on some firms, there was a little bit of, well, there's a lot of interest, and not many people got all their shares, of course, because they were oversubscribed. But the point is, that I think is really interesting here, is that the institutions really got a lot of this. Now, maybe that was payback, because this is what happens, gang. Maybe it was payback for the flop of Facebook. Now, there's different players involved here, but remember something. If the lead players give to their institutions and they give them a good deal, hey, doesn't that make them somewhat beholden or at least owing a favor back. In other words, an institutional investor, a mutual fund, gets a great allocation from Goldman or whatever the particular distributor of this particular IPO is, and they give it to them at a great price. They get an inside price, and they give a lot more to the institutions this time. Why? Well, they win over their business. Pretty much it's free money. I don't think anybody is really surprised about that, right? But it does, again, cement the whole idea that it is an institutionally run market. And what we want to do is be our own persons and thinking about things in terms of investing, but at the same time, following along somewhat with the institutions. Unfortunately, you probably can't get the same allocation that they received for this IPO or other IPOs. But I will tell you that beware of jumping in an IPO at a market order, which is, let me just say it, it's stupid. You don't know where it's going to open. You're only hoping that you're going to get a great pop on the price. And maybe it will happen. But the likelihood of that happening is very remote because you have a lot of other people doing the same stupid thing of putting in a market order for an IPO, therefore pushing up the price. And that's really what happened here. I think the price of Twitter hit about 50 the first day. Then it slipped back. And it was down 8% on its second day of trading. Was it impressive? Sure. It was a great IPO for the insiders. Was it good for anybody that bought in the aftermarket so far? No. It ended close to its low on Friday. Therefore, there's no way that anybody that bought in the aftermarket, unless they were really lucky somehow, which I don't know how that would have happened, that they're making money. They're actually losing money on the deal. Now, I'm not really talking about this for anything more than the first 2 days of trading, obviously, and I'm not really even speaking to the idea of if it's a good stock or a bad stock, a good company, or if it has promise moving forward. I'm just sharing with you what not to do. Don't be suckered in. If you can get an allocation of an IPO and you think it's a really good company or a great opportunity, hey, that's great. One of the rules that we have here, because we've been involved in IPOs for a couple of decades, and we said, finally, you know what, we're not going to do this. There were some great deals back in the day. But the new rule is, if any IPO is available to us, if we can get shares on it, we don't want it. Think about that. Kind of a Groucho Marx thing, right? Or maybe it was Woody Allen. Anyway, any club, any organization that would have him as a member, he does not want to be a member of. Any IPO that we get shares of, we don't want. Why? Because that means there's a ton of availability. Even though we do a lot of trading with some firms, and even though we have a good block of business. I mean, the fact of the matter is that usually about 50 or more percent goes to the institutions, and it's very rare to get anything of reasonable size. And what I mean by this also is, by the way, yeah, we can get shares of some of these, but you know what? We only get a couple. We have to share it with all of our clients, and we're not going to offer two or three shares. If you get maybe 500 shares on a total order, you put in a request for, you know, 15,000 shares and you only get 100 or 200. There's just nothing to that. So beware of IPOs, beware of the excitement and the pump and all the things that go along with it, because it's all we heard about for about, I guess, a week or 2 weeks right before of it. And the good news is that we didn't have to hear all about the tapering and the Fed a little, you know, calm down a little bit. We had something that was in the way, and now all of a sudden it's gone. So now we have all about the Fed and taper again. Let's talk about that for a second. On Friday, the jobs number came out and the unemployment rate was 7.3%. up from 7.2, and we saw that there was an addition to the payrolls by about 204,000, and most economists and analysts had expected about 120,000. That is a tremendous differential, especially due to the fact that it was expected that the government shutdown would have a lot more to do with the jobs number and cause a temporary setback. Now, one of a couple of things happened. One, there was a lot of part-time hiring that went on. We saw that inside the number, and therefore, that may have been seasonal hiring for the holidays and retail and restaurants, etc. The second thing is that it is possible that there's still some problems with the data that has been flowing through. For example, California was late with the data a couple of times on the initial claims, and who knows what the actual numbers are and how they're flowing through right now, and who knows really what the counting was, how the counting was done on the government. So in other words, were furloughs counted or not? Were they maybe before the number is taken out, then put back in and count it again? Or did we just have a great hiring period? You know, just defying all odds and having just a great hiring period, even though we saw the Michigan confidence rating go down to about 71.5, much lower than anticipated today. But here's what was interesting about what happened when the number came out. So the number comes out at 8:30 on Friday, and futures were inching up a little bit into it just to kind of, you know, towards a +3, +2, +4. And the number comes out, and all of a sudden, there was a realization that, wait, we got a lot better hiring than we thought. Unemployment's still kind of low. Wow. The dollar shot up. The euro came in. The yen went down. And futures just tanked. They went from about a +2, +3 to about a -8 or 9. Or maybe it was, yeah, about -8, I believe. That's a big move. You got about a 10-point move on the S&P 500 is equivalent to, give or take, about a 90-point move on the Dow Jones, give or take. Now, immediately, it sat there. It thought about it for a while, and then all of a sudden it started coming up a little bit. Well, it didn't come up very fast, but it came up a bit. Dollar kept on rising. It was up as high as about a 0.5% or a little bit more against the basket of currencies. And then the market opens. Things come in a little bit. They start getting a little bit closer. And by the time the University of Michigan confidence number comes out, there was some nice positives to the S&P. Now, this is after a day of a pretty significant bloodbath, particularly for momentum stocks, on Thursday. What was the reason? I don't know. There wasn't any particular reason why that happened, but there was just maybe a little bit of things are priced okay, and there wasn't a lot of buying, so the selling persisted. In fact, it was on much higher volume. So now fast forward, all these things are really in the doghouse, and we see a big drop on major markets, one of the worst days of the NASDAQ in months, and one of the worst days on the small caps in a while. And here we are, Friday, starting to come up. The confidence number comes out, and it's a very big disappointment, and again, futures started tailing off, and from there on, that was it. It was a constant stream of buying. Till the small caps pretty much brought back all of their losses from Thursday, and the NASDAQ did the same, and the Dow hit a new all-time record. How was that? Do you think about, like, what's going on here? One of the things that's going on is that as we're seeing that there is a move to buy the dip on any dip, it can be a 5-minute dip or a 2-day dip, it doesn't matter, is because there's a lot of money coming into the markets right now in the form of flows into mutual funds. That's a sign that retail is obviously doing their thing to fund their mutual funds. As a matter of fact, if you look back, there was about $3 billion of equity funds, excluding ETFs, that came in for the week last week. And the ETFs had net outflows of about $5 billion for the week. Bonds had outflows. Money markets had some inflows. Municipal bonds had outflows and redemptions of about $1 billion. And overall, mutual fund investors contributed about $3.3 billion in the week. And what's interesting about this is, and this was the end of last week into this week, we're seeing a lot more people seemingly saying, hey, you know what? I see this market go. I've been out of it for a while, and I don't want it to go any further without me. Now, oftentimes, the last one in on the rally, on the party, the one left holding the bag, so to speak, is retail. They're late in, they're late out. Is this the case this time? It's possible. We are seeing a different move on markets, and that's probably why we're seeing it, is because retail is investing, and mutual funds have a lot of excess money, and they have to deploy it. So therefore, if there's money that comes in the day before, the next day they're going to deploy that money. And therefore, that's why we see the pop at the open. We see the pop at the close. They're kind of spending their money throughout the day, but they need to get it in there. And they don't want to do it at all one shot because it will move the market too much, because liquidity is pretty light. It's been light for a couple of years now. Even though we talk about liquidity that is out there, sure. But in the markets, if you've been trading stocks, you'll know that you can push a stock pretty easily with a small lot. So what's happening right now is that we are seeing a lot of inflows, and maybe even because the European Stability Fund was downgraded. France was downgraded last week from a AA plus, I believe it was, to a AA. And we also saw that there was not a lot of movement with the Japanese policy. One thing that was a surprise last week, a mind-blowing surprise actually, was that the ECB, the equivalent of the Bernanke over here, dropped their interest rates, their key interest rates, by 25 basis points, from 50 basis points down to 0.25. And what's really fascinating about that is that they have been holding that steady for some time. Every single economist had estimated there would be no change, and the ECB had no signaling that there would be a change at all or a additional loosening of policy. Well, that happened, and immediately, and this is maybe one of the reasons why on Thursday there were such problems, because it was a big surprise. It dropped the euro. The dollar came screaming higher. We saw that gold was selling off. We saw that the that crude oil was selling off again, because you get this big, very surprising move in currencies, and that starts to whack things out across the board. And then from there, what happens is that there was just a lot of confusion. There was a big move up initially on the ECB move on the futures, and then it just started turning around and jamming backwards pretty hard. So, you know, there's a lot of things that we look at to determine where we are in terms of the economic cycle. And clearly what we're seeing is at the end of there's a trough, which is the recession time. And then you got the next, which is recovery, and you got the topping of it, then the roll down again into trough. Right now we're on either the left side or the right side of the mountain of the recovery. It seems like some of the jobs numbers are picking up. Manufacturing is just okay. Services, okay. And when you look at the rest of the economics that are out there, they've been hit or miss. We put out that economic surprise index last week on the site, and you could see that there was a lot of very disappointing numbers of late. So right now we're in this strange time period that we're seeing a lot of choppy numbers when it comes to the economics, and earnings have been very choppy, and the outlooks have been, you know, quite not happy. They've been, you know, mediocre to down. So there's a very strange time, and that's why we're seeing such choppiness in the markets. Well, let's get to our guest, and then I'm going to talk about Tesla. I'm going to talk about a mistake that can be avoided, and a couple other things that I think you'll find of interest. Today, we're going to change it up in terms of not just talking about the markets, of course, but I want to talk about some of the aspects of how do you set yourself up? You know, if you're trading or you're investing, sometimes you want to know, well, you know, what's the best way for me to handle my accounts? And there's a lot of different things out there, a lot of different ways to do it. And I thought we'd bring on a gentleman who knows about this. His name is Clint Coons. He's an attorney with Anderson Business Advisors. And we have a couple of things that he and I have been talking about that are really interesting. So I thought Clint, you'd bring some interesting aspects to our show today. So thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me on. Interesting aspects, absolutely. We scare some people, for sure.
Yeah. I hear you. So let's kind of, there's so many things I want to talk about. Let's start with the whole idea of trading. So when an individual is a quote unquote professional trader, they get some benefits because they can actually set up like a business, right? But you've kind of said that there's some better ways to do this.
Correct. I mean, if you want to go on the market and you want to classify yourself as an active trader and claim trader status, there's great opportunities for you to do that. And I do have a few clients that have actually met the trader status test. But the problem invariably for these individuals is that it's a lifelong commitment, essentially, to become a trader. That is, they have to trade every day. The tests that have come down, and it's not by the IRS. They don't tell you if you do this, or it's not written in the tax code. If you do X, Y, and Z, you meet this test. It's all been accumulated through case law. And what it typically requires of an individual is that they have to trade every day, 2 to 3 round-trip trades a day. So these are short-term investors who are in and out of the market. It has to be their sole source of income, basically how they're supporting themselves. And, you know, they can take some time off maybe for vacation, but they have to show an intent to make the majority of their trading income strictly from trading in the stock market. So this has been a problem for a lot of clients. I've worked with traders for 15 years. In fact, I used to be an active trader myself. And I saw the problems they were facing, that when they put on their tax return, hey, I'm an active trader, they're basically telling the IRS, if you have some free time, why don't you come out of my house and audit me? Because the fact is that when you're an active trader, you have to look at your tax return and all your expenses, let's say the education expenses you may obtain in learning how to trade better or set up better trades, those are going to go on a Schedule C on your tax return because you're claiming it's an active business for you, but all of your income will go on Schedule D. So now you have this dichotomy where you're sending in your tax returns and you're showing losses on the Schedule C portion, which are great losses to have because you can offset them against all forms of income, but you're showing all your income as if you're an investor. And this confuses agents. When they look at that return, they make an assumption that, hey, this guy's running a hobby-type business and he's trying to take all these losses and use it to offset all forms of income. And so it just invites scrutiny. And so it's been kind of a bit of a headache for a lot of my clients that have attempted to obtain the status.
Right. It's a red flag, in other words, that if you're showing all of this and you're not really, the problem is that it's easy for the IRS to then pull it out and say, okay, let's get this guy to prove it.
Correct. That is the problem.
Yeah.
And if you look what's going on right now with the IRS and with Obama and Obamacare, I mean, the whole intent here has been in the last several years is that we need to generate more tax revenue, and the one way to do that is through enforcement. And so we've seen in our practice, because we have both a legal and a tax side to our practice, that the number of audits has actually gone up, and that's come from the top. Obama did state on numerous occasions that more revenue would be collected through enforcement actions, that there are people out there who are under-reporting their taxes. And so you see this more aggressive approach taken by the IRS. I mean, I can tell you, we set up retirement plans, as you and I were talking about. And just in the last year, I think 8 of our retirement accounts for our clients that we've set up, 8 of them have been audited. In the last 15 Really? Years, we've only had 8 audited. So that shows this disturbing trend towards an opportunity for the IRS to find additional funds.
You know, that is definitely, there's no question, by the way, that there's only a few ways that they can raise revenue. And obviously, it's very clear that they're going to do it through taxes, which, by the way, is very not good for your reelection or the reelection of your party, right? And secondly, and just, you know, Congress can't do that. They, you know, everybody's going to theoretically vote against it. But quietly behind the scenes, doing enforcement actions or audits or doing a better job at making sure collections are done is a much easier, and it's almost apolitical, right? There's nothing that can be done about it. It's an enforcement action, and it's not like, well, that's the rules, that's what you have to do. So nobody actually is saying it's a bad thing to do, and that is exactly what's happening. For example, with you look at SAC Capital, you look at all these different players, JP Morgan paying, you know, however many billions of dollars they're paying. That's the new way of doing things, which, by the way, I don't have an objection to, because if you're smart enough to use the tax law in your favor legally, by the law, by the code, hey, that's great. But those people that are not doing the right thing should pay their whatever their particular rate and requirement is, right?
Oh, if only it was that easy. I mean, I agree with, in principle, everything you said.
Yeah, I understand. No, of course, in principle. Yeah.
Reality doesn't happen that way.
Well, yeah. Well, we just talk about theory here and what would be nice to see. So one of the things we talked about was that there's an alternative now for traders. Now, again, we're talking about professional traders or people that trade actively that claim quote-unquote trader status, right? So one of the things they do, like you mentioned, is have great records, trade as many, you know, all the different rules that require them to trade daily, and you know, they can use their expenses offsetting it. What's the other alternative?
Well, the other alternative than claiming trader status is to actually set up a business and treat it like a business. So now you've taken yourself out of that trader tax status classification, and now we're just focusing on creating and running an actual trading business. So you're no longer considered to be an individual trader. I've converted that over to a business activity. And for many people, they found that we work with, using entities such as a corporation or a limited liability company or a limited partnership coupled together, they can achieve the benefits they're looking for from a tax deduction standpoint, that is, they can write off their expenses, and they don't have to necessarily commit to this in and out of the market 2 to 3 times a day, strategy trading every day of the year, because by forming the business, they're showing their intent to treat it as something other than an investor, so they're not held to the same high standard as an individual. And a lot of this really comes down to, when you look at trader status itself, is that the people who are trying to claim active trader status, there's a benefit there, and that is you're able to, you know, claim the expenses, as I said, on your Schedule C, which can be used to offset all forms of income. So those are the best expenses you can get.
Mm-hmm.
You're also able to take back your income into prior years to offset losses. So that's another benefit of claiming. And the thing is, you don't have to pay self-employment taxes on any of the income. So you're actually best aspects of the tax code and putting them all together in this nice little neat package. And so that's in why you're going to have more scrutiny there, because there's so many benefits to you. Whereas if you're a business and you take the opportunity to set up a formal entity and recognize it as such, you've shown an intent that you want to change how you're conducting your trading. And the ancillary benefits that comes from running a business in this manner is you also have asset protection. I mean, you know, I'm an attorney, and so, you know, our ilk, what do we typically do? We look for people that have deep pockets, and anybody that is considered to have assets in their own name is always an attractive target if I was considering bringing in a lawsuit. So one of the aspects you obtain by creating the business is you move those assets out of your name, so you don't make yourself such an attractive target to an attorney who may be on a fishing expedition looking for somebody to sue.
Now, as an attorney, you're uniquely qualified to answer my next question. And it's something that's always annoyed me. Why do you use the long paper and those gigantic files that make it very difficult for us human beings to actually do anything with them aside from just folding them?
Because they're billed by the word.
Ah, so you get more words on the page?
Yeah.
Is that what it is?
Something like that.
Oh, boy. Do you still use those legal size papers?
No, I've never used that stuff. Most everything now is you've gone electronic. You try not to
burn down
a small forest.
Come on, how many files did you have in the old days that you had to fold something up? You know what I mean? In the bottom part of it?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, my God. It's so annoying. And then you couldn't copy it right, and it wouldn't fit. And anyway, I just thought I'd ask
that's
that.
That's called
as a
job security
note
for us. That's why we do it that way.
All right. So now we see that, obviously as trader status, you can benefit by possibly doing, sometimes a company, I'm assuming an LLC, a subchapter S, something like that.
Well, it really depends on how active they want to be. A lot of times I'll utilize a two entity strategy where I'll have their brokerage account held in a limited partnership for asset protection purposes. And I'll have a C corporation managing that limited partnership. And the corporation is tied in for a percentage ownership on the gains, plus it's paid a management fee, which is a guaranteed payment to the corporation on a monthly basis for the activity. So my clients that are involved in this, they're actually trading the limited partnership's brokerage account as an officer of the corporation, because that's their role in this endeavor. So they make the trades as a president of XYZ Inc., and then they pay that corporation a set fee every month for its activity.
Right. Gotcha. Okay. Let's switch over to something, because one of the things that is really interesting is that we talked about how with IRAs, for example, IRAs, there is a special margin that you can use in your retirement plan that you can allow yourself to trade things that may not ordinarily been able to be traded, more of an administrative function. Whereas, for example, IRA is usually considered a cash account. And if you trade something and you buy a stock ABC and sell it and then want to buy it back the next day, there may be a time period that you have to wait because it's a cash account. But certain brokerage firms allow you to have special IRA margin on there for the ability to not be a cash account, not to leverage, but not to be a cash account where you have certain wait times for clearing. Now, one step further is that there is something that you and I have talked about and you brought up, which is utilizing leverage or, doing a leveraged buy. For example, you have $100,000 and for whatever reason, you want to buy $120,000 worth of one stock or many stocks and lever up your account. Explain how that works.
Okay, so with buying on margin or leveraging your account, you're correct. With an IRA, you're not allowed to do that, but you can set up your own private pension plan. It can be a solo 401k, it can be a 401k, defined contribution plan, and it would be a natural outgrowth of establishing a trading entity. You could connect it to that trading entity, and you can then can roll your IRA, you can't do a roll Roth, but you can roll your IRA into this account. Now, another benefit as well is that if, say, you and your spouse have IRAs, you can actually roll all the IRAs into one account. Now you don't have to trade multiple accounts. You can just have it in one pooled account. And then when you have that money there and you set it up with your broker, whoever you're trading with, you have the flexibility now to not only trade as you described, but you can also utilize leveraged trades inside of that account, because the rules permit that as long as it's held in a defined contribution or an ERISA-qualified plan, which is an IRA does not meet that definition. That's why it's not permitted inside of the IRA. One other benefit as well is that when people roll their funds into a qualified plan, like I just described, you also have the opportunity, should you need it, to borrow against those funds. I mean, with an IRA, you do not have the opportunity to borrow your funds. Right. Actually, you take it out for 60 days and you got to put it back. But with a pension, you can borrow up to $50,000 out of your account, and you will have to repay it over 5 years, but there's some flexibility there that you don't necessarily have inside of an IRA. So that's how I prefer to see people trading. You know, pool accounts, they can also contribute to it, and they get the flexibility to borrow and use the leverage.
Now, how do you get the money from the IRA into the pension? Now, if you have it set up as an IRA rollover originally, you can move it. Can you just move any IRA into a pension?
You can move any IRA except for a Roth IRA.
Right.
You
cannot
move a Roth IRA in there.
Right.
Yeah, and it's relatively simple. I was just working with a client this morning in filling out an application for her broker under a qualified plan that I had created for her off of her corporation. And she is going to be rolling her funds plus her husband's IRA into this account, and she'll be investing through one pooled account.
Hmm. So what you have there is the benefit of some aspects of, can you go short in that account?
Yeah.
Can you short trade? Okay. So you get to short trade, leverage up, buy long, and things like that. Now, the difficulty, though, now there's more reporting, right? There has to be an administrator. There has to be an annual form that is filed. Right? What are we talking about there? Because the question then is, you know, okay, fine. I got a $25,000 IRA. Does that make any sense?
$25,000 IRA, I don't know if I would recommend you do that.
Right. Yeah. Right. Yeah. So the fact is, it has to be a larger IRA. You have to be desirous of trading and things like that, of course, because if you want to use the short, if you want to use the leverage and all that, because otherwise, what's the point? But it's still protected under ERISA and the asset protection as well through retirement plan protection, right?
Well, you'd have to bring on one other participant into your corporation. That is, you'd have to hire a child and make them an employee, eventually a participant in the plan. And yes, you would be protected under ERISA. But if it's just you, you're going to get the same protections that are afforded the IRA under state law. So
yeah.
So to do that, but
so you're not recommending child labor, are you?
Well, it depends. I was an indentured servant for 27 years for my parents, and from their perspective, it turned out okay.
Yeah, I'm married now, so I continue on the quest.
Yeah, that's right.
But you will have to file forms. Now, what about, you mentioned how you could combine accounts, let's say your husband and wife, but then you have to then do further valuations, right, of values of either or, so you have that on, through you know, for your forms and for your tracking of that. So again, there's a little bit more that goes into this.
There's a little bit more that goes into it, but if you're creating a pooled account, you're tracking it when it's going in, so you have the relative balances of each account so you know what the percentages are, and then you're trading it collectively so that then the profits would be split based upon those percentages on the way in. And, you know, mm-hmm. if I could just back up one step here, you mentioned about alternative types of trades that most people cannot conduct inside of their IRA or even their regular pension plan. What individuals don't realize is that when you create a pension plan, you can specify in your plan documents what types of trades are permissible under your trust agreement. And for most brokers, they limit the types of trades people can enter into under their plan documents. Whereas when we drafted our plan document, we opened it up. Any trade you can think of that's permissible, you can do under our plan. And when you open up an account there, many times a broker's going to want to see a copy of your plan documents to see what trades are actually authorized in that plan.
Right. Well, it's interesting, actually, because in IRA, for example, if you want to hold maybe some, I don't call it closely held, but some real estate that's maybe privately held somewhere, it could be difficult because the custodian has to be a special custodian. They have to get valuations on an annual basis, et cetera. Well, in a pension plan, it's a lot easier to hold alternative assets.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, it's funny you bring that up because there's a new proposal out now for 5498, which is the annual reporting by the IRA custodian to the IRS, where they, starting next year, they're going to require that they let the Internal Revenue Service know the types of alternative investments that are currently being held inside of the plan. So they're drilling down to determine what people are doing inside of their IRAs because they want to gather more information. And I think there's only one reason for that, is they're looking for additional sources of revenue through audits in case people engage in derivative transactions.
And if anybody thinks that that's going to be a temporary issue, that they're going to limit enforcement actions, limit the amount of money that they spend on trying to recover assets or revenue from places that maybe they haven't in the past, I think you have some thinking to do, because really it is the easiest way, because the average amount of revenue that's brought in per agent salary is a tremendous multiple. And it makes a lot of sense for them to do that, and nobody gets upset about it. I mean, like we said before. So I think that's really important. Now, in terms of asset protection, you know, one of the things that always amazes me is that people think that they put their money in a trust, and then the assets are protected. You know, it's you can't have any kind of opening now, and if you have any kind of a claim by some creditor or maybe a liability claim, well, my assets are protected because they're in a trust. And I don't know where this came from. You know, where this notion came from that seems to be out there. Not everybody thinks this, but, you know, one of the things that I think you could explain is, you know, if an individual has a revocable trust that's in their name that they have power over, that is also tied to maybe their Social Security number, there is no asset protection. Because if you own it, you have full rights to it, right?
Well, do you want asset protection for that type of trust?
Well, I'm saying that there's this notion out there that if you have this kind of trust, you also have asset protection because it's inside of a trust.
There is that notion, and the only time you're going to gain that asset protection is by taking one affirmative action on your behalf, and that is you have to die. And, you know, personally, yeah, I don't want to die in order to protect my assets, so you're right. I don't look at my revocable trust as an asset protection tool because it's not.
Right, and the reason why when you die is because that trust then becomes irrevocable, and that trust then gets a new tax ID number. So the thing is that if you think about it, if ever you have an asset that you have control over, and by the way, even if you set up a trust and you have full control over it and you have ability to take out any amount of money you have, even if it may have a separate tax ID, there could be some question as to the actual ownership of the assets inside of there, and it can be tracked back to you, right?
Correct. So what you're referring to now is a self-settled asset protection trust that are set up in a handful of states right now. And when you look at those statutes, they all have one similarity or one thing in common, and that is the individual who creates that form of trust cannot have control over the distribution. That is, they cannot distribute assets out to themselves. You have to have an independent third party making that decision. You can decide how the assets are invested, but you can't pull the money out unless the third party agrees to distribute it to you.
It's almost the same as constructive receipt rules. If you have the ability to have that money and do something with it, whether or not you actually do something with it, it may be deemed that you have enough ownership power over it that it is includable in your asset base. So just as a point of reference, a side note for people listening, if you do have a trust and you think it is, you know, a great because it does all these wonderful things for your estate planning, and then you really think that there's some asset protection, you may have to really do a little bit more thinking about that. So anyway, lots of legal issues that we could talk about. We probably spend most of the day talking about that. But listen, Clint, I want to let you know that I really appreciate it. I know that you have some newsletters that you put out. What we're going to do is is it okay? Can we put this the special report that you sent me on trader status?
Sure, absolutely.
Okay. So what we'll do is we'll put that on the show notes of this episode, and we'll put all the information on how people can contact you and, you know, find out more about it. And if anybody's interested in, you know, the issue of trader status or asset protection, whatever it may be. And we'll have this on there so they can take a look at it. So I do appreciate you coming along today.
Thank you.
All right, great. Clint Coons from over at, of course, Anderson Business Advisors. Now, not all of you are traders, of course. Some of you are investors, and some of you are not even professional traders. But you know what? The knowledge that we get from some of these guests, I think, are invaluable, because you never know. One day, you'll know somebody, you'll become a trader that wants to know a little bit more about taxes, and maybe a little bell will go off, and you'll say, hey, you know what? I remember hearing about that on that show. So that's why we try to bring you a broad range of people that will give you some insight that maybe isn't only market related directly, but gives you some other things to think about. By the way, I'll be on Frank Curzio's show next week. So if you have the opportunity, I think it's going to be broadcast on all sorts of radio stations around the country too. So listen to Frank Curzio, and he has the Stansberry radio show. And you know where to find him, on iTunes, or just go search the web for Frank Curzio podcast and you'll find him, and I'll be on it next week. I'll also want to mention to you, by the way, that, you know, one of the things that we talk about quite often is trading and markets and, you know, active positions. We actually have a couple different strategies. One of them is a trading strategy, which you know about. The other is the global allocation strategies, where we have a much more, I'll call it, quote unquote, traditional style and approach, where we utilize more of a macro global orientation, where we're looking at larger diversified positions in things that are, for example, not only U.S. based, but also foreign and bonds and unhedged and hedged and commodities, et cetera. And we do this inside of mutual funds, institutional mutual funds, and ETFs. So if you're interested in that, just drop me an email or go over to the site. You could fill out a form or contact us. If you're looking to kind of say, hey, you know what? I've been in this portfolio for a while, and is it getting toppy? Am I in the right position? We'll do an analysis for you, and we will tell you what we think about it, and we'll tell you if there's something that can be done. If there's not, and if you're in great shape, hey, that's great. But more oftentimes than not, we save a lot of money for people, because the fees that you're usually paying in mutual funds can't be matched by the stuff we get in the institutional style funds that we have, you know, all of them that are available. We don't have just a few. We have all of them, anything we want to, you know, choose from. So we do an incredible job at scrubbing through those. So you can check that out. All right, let's talk about Tesla. Talk about Tesla. Now, you know, I've been whining about Tesla for a while. If you listen to DH Unplugged and you heard me here, you know that I've been talking about the valuation problem and the problem of, hey, wait a minute. Last time Tesla came out with this number and there was all these one-time items, and how can they actually do that again? Because they're one-time items. And I was scratching my head wondering, what in the world? How is this going to play out? And how are they going to keep this growth up? And, you know, then I looked at the car and I'm like, wow, that car is awesome. That is just a great car. And I started thinking about all the numbers that were being bought and produced and all the talk about it and all my friends that love it. And then I started saying, oh yeah, but we got all these one-time items, a lot of one-time items. Now, meanwhile, the stock had one of the worst weeks it's had in a very long time. It was down close to 20-something percent at one point. And over a couple-day period, it was down probably 20%. Now, we actually were short the position, and we've been shorting in and out of it, back and forth, going short, and then covering and short and covering until we get a nice rip down, about 15 points or so. Covered it at support. Could have made a few extra dollars, but that was where the level we felt was kind of a no man's land, you know, that was not really shortable or viable. Then we bought it back. We actually bought Tesla at the support level in the about 140, and then when it dropped on Friday, we picked up another piece at the secondary support level, and that actually came back and evened our position out really nicely, because the stock really cratered for a little bit there. We picked it up, and it ramped right back. Now, the reason I'm telling you this is that sometimes you want to take a look at some of these stocks that are falling out of favor. Now, you know, you have to be careful about this, but one of the things you want to do is you want to find those really good support levels. And when you find those support levels, you start just slowly buying into the stock. If it comes down, make sure you have a couple of support levels that you can identify. And then the next thing, you buy a little bit more, buy a little bit more. Now, if it cracks that final support where you say, hey, wait a minute, this is no good anymore, then you get out. But in a market that is very forgiving, in an environment that we see one day with a gigantic swoop down and then the next day a giant swoop up, it makes sense to think about doing something like that, because even a stock like US Silica, SLCA, that had an announcement on Thursday evening after the close that there was going to be an inside shareholder selling a gigantic position. Stock was down 8% on the open on Friday and finished down like 1.5, 2. That's some pretty solid numbers in terms of the desire to buy that stock. So I think that you want to look at that. Of course, you could do the opposite as well. You start shorting into something a situation where it's really popping higher and hitting resistance. And then if it comes down, of course, you cover it at support. But, you know, you find your particular level that is going to be nowhere, no man's land. Now, I'll mention that, you know, when you're looking at stocks, a lot of times people do this. They buy a stock, maybe they make money, they lose some money, maybe you short a stock, you make some money, you lose some money. And then there's those stocks, you know, the stocks that just don't work for you. You try it, you want to get in there, and then you just lose your money. You do it again, maybe, whether it's short or long, and it just doesn't work for you. And you're like, I'm done with that stock. Big mistake. You don't know if your timing is right, and you don't know if you really should have been in that position, whether, again, long or short, and you just mistimed it. And for whatever reason, you're desiring to just look the other way. Well, keep that on your watch list. You know, Green Mountain Coffee is like one of, for me, I mean, it's like, you know, you go into it, we believe it's a short, and it comes down a little bit, then it ramps higher, and the next thing you know, you do it a couple times, like, all right, put it on the side over here. We just don't have the rhythm with it. The next thing you know, it goes from 80 to 60. Like, oh, I knew that was going to happen. Don't be afraid to get back into a position if you have all of the indications that make sense to you and show that this is going to work. It may not work right now. Okay, you move into it, you get out of it. If it doesn't work, you take your loss, and then you try it again. Now, this is not a continual process. Obviously, if you just can't get it, you can't get it. One of the things that we had, I'll mention to you that I mentioned also before about avoiding mistakes, right? Well, here's a mistake. About 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago, a company called Select Comfort, which is a mattress company, came out with earnings and they bombed. Bombed pretty hard. Now, these are companies that have been doing pretty well for a while. Then, you know, the housing market picked up and really ramped up. And boy, this thing just flopped. Well, there's a couple other players in that area. One of them is Tempur Sealy, TPX. So we looked at the stock and we said, you know what, we're going to take a short position in this. Their earnings coming up in about a week and a half, 2 weeks. And the likelihood is that, you know, if one company in this area isn't doing well, there's probably going to be the same problem with another company. So we take a small position in it and we build on a little bit on the short side. You know, one of the things I noticed was, hey, you know what, this stock is not really dropping. This stock is holding up pretty well, as a matter of fact. In fact, when the Select Comfort came out, it was down 7%. And so the Comfort was down about 25%. And then by the end of the day or the next day, the stock kind of gradually just started rising higher again. It still was down, but it wasn't down that much. Now you kind of fast forward, and this is going on for about 7 or 8 days now, maybe a couple of weeks, and you say, the stock is just holding up too well. What's up with that? And then the earnings come out. And lo and behold, they beat, and the stock is now up by 14 or 15%, and you're going to take a big loss on this. Now, what's the lesson learned on this? Sometimes the lesson learned is that if a stock is too strong and it is defying gravity in the face of all other known information, maybe there's a reason. Now, maybe the insiders were picking it up. Maybe there was a little bit of a discussion somewhere that they're going to do very well, and a lot of people were buying the shares and because they knew that. Whatever the situation is, the fact is it looked like in the beginning that it was a real good play. It had a very good pattern for shorting. It soon became questionable, and the question then was, really, should we just beg out of this and to kind of be done with this till after earnings and see what happens? Now, the good news was the same day, so this week, there was in our portfolio, it just happened to offset, well, not only offset, it actually did a lot better. So we lost 15%, let's say, on or 17% total on Tempur-Pedic, but there was a stock buyout Thursday evening. The stock was halted. Santorus, which is in the health and the biotech and pharmaceutical area. This is a stock that I've liked for a long time. We have recently wrote it up for a while, came back down, we bought it, bought some more of it, and they got halted on Thursday evening because of, well, I thought it was earnings. I mean, they were coming out with earnings, so I thought it was earnings. So the stock gets halted. I'm like, what's going on with that? A little research. Turns out they're being bought by Salix Pharmaceuticals, and the stock was up 37%. So that made up for the differential. But the point is that, Tempur-Pedic is a lesson learned in watching the pattern and the behavior of a stock. And Santoros is a lesson in, hey, you know what? I had the stock. I did very well with it. It came in, and you know what? It's back down to a price that I want to buy it. I'm going back to it. So the lesson here is twofold. One is, you know, if a stock is not behaving correctly, well, maybe there's a reason for that. And the second thing is, don't be afraid to get back into something, even if you had a profit or a loss, because there may be another opportunity if it stays on meeting all your criteria from a fundamental basics and also technical. So I think that is a couple of things that really you should take to heart and you should, you know, really internalize, because if you don't, you know, you're going to be out there looking constantly for a new position. You know, one of the things you can do as an investor is know the stocks that you are involved with, not just trying to use a shotgun approach entirely and just picking things that are different all the time, but have a core list, which may change. Our list changes because of fundamentals, but have a core list of positions that you are going to be actively looking for when they break out, when they break down, when they're actually moving in the direction that you believe they should because of all the patterns that you see, or if they're not behaving correctly, what does that mean? And therefore, change your orientation, change what you're doing. You know, change the aspect of your belief in what's happening as best as possible. It's very difficult, by the way, right? You know, we all get into a belief that this stock is good, this stock is bad, and, you know, you kind of get into that mode. I also mentioned, by the way, one of the great ways to, I think one of the great ways to get yourself out of the whole idea of, you know, I'm stuck on this whole thesis about a stock because fundamentals are good or fundamentals are bad, is to look at the technicals. You got to look at the stock chart and the patterns and what's happening. So we did a great webinar last week. We have one next week with Corey Rosenblum. I mean, I thought it was great. We had a packed house, virtually. It's on the web where we do have interaction there. But we had a packed house, and we're having another one, the second part of it, next week. There's a replay of the one we did this week on triggercharts.com. And I really encourage you, if you want to learn more about trading and utilizing algorithms and utilizing some of the good methodology that we have, and Corey is totally on board with what we do in terms of the technical side of this with volume and price of time. And you really want to attend that. It's kind of neat, you know, because it's fun. You find out what's going on and how patterns look. And every time you learn something about the markets and about investing, it makes you better, I think. Now, I'm not talking about just news. I'm talking about technique. I'm talking about how to understand things, how to read the overall behavior, not only of the stock, but of the market and other investors. It's not always easy, especially not now, where we have interference by the Fed. That is causing all sorts of grief. But it is what it is, right? I know you hate when I say that, but the fact is the Fed is there, and right now we have to deal with it. I don't know how they're going to get out, by the way. I've kind of sat and thought, okay, how does the Fed get out? Because the number that came out last week that we saw on the jobs number, not only did it push up the dollar and bring up stocks, but bonds got obliterated. You look at TBT, which is the inverse long, it was up about, I don't know, 4.8% on Friday. That means that interest rates went up, and that's not what the Fed wants. So they're going to have to stay in and keep on buying. So if the jobs number was good, they're going to have to stay in and no taper. If the job number is bad, they have to stay in and no taper. Fact is, they're in. They're not getting out. At least I don't see a way for them to get out. Because almost any number that you can throw out, you can find a reason why they should stay in. If the unemployment rate gets to, let's say, 6.7%, they could say, well, the labor participation rate dropped. As a matter of fact, it did. It dropped off significantly in last month. Last month was the lowest since the 70s of the labor participation rate that we've seen, meaning that more people left the workforce, thereby helping to drop the unemployment rate, even though it rose a bit. So if we didn't have that, think about that, the unemployment rate could have been 7.8%. Meh. So what does that say? Well, we got Twitter IPO we learned about today a little bit and how not to play the IPO. We know about mistakes that can be made and not to shy away from stocks. Keep it on your watch list. We also learned about how to read a little bit of the markets. And also with Clint Coons, we talked about how to set yourself up as a trader and to get the most out of the potential tax breaks that are available. Now, next week's going to bring a little less economics. We'll have some, but we'll also see the tail end of earnings that we're finally getting to the end of here. Story's the same. Companies are beating by a little bit. Growth is there in terms of EPS, but revenues falling a bit short. Outlook, you know, even Priceline came out with Outlook. Stock was down about 10% on their commentary that they were really concerned about the outlook moving forward. And lo and behold, it was up 5% during the next day's session. This is because people are not believing that they are really serious. They are guiding very conservatively. So therefore, if they always guide conservatively and they seem to beat things, well, we'll just invest in it. I mean, they did a good job. They really did nicely beat both the revenue and the EPS for the current period. But they did guide lower, and you just wonder, what's the point of even guiding anymore, because we're just ignoring it entirely. Anyway, next week, we'll be here again. Again, we have Frank Curzio coming up. I'll be on his podcast, and that's starting, I guess it'll be Monday or Tuesday. That will be out of next week. And we're also going to have on thedisciplinedinvestor.com on Monday, we're going to put the entire series of all the employment numbers and charts that you can take a look at, so you can see exactly what's happening with the unemployment rate and the underemployment rate, the actual differential between the ADP and the BLS, and also the labor participation rate. You really should look at that, because it's very interesting to see how the labor participation rate has really dropped off. And that's not a good thing, because less people are actually working, that means. So now, even though there was a lot more people that were added to the payrolls, a lot more people dropped out of the workforce. So that's a big problem. Thanks for joining me. Again, you can email me at askandrew@thedisciplinedinvestor.com. You can ask me any question you want about anything. DH Unplugged is on Tuesday. And, of course, you can catch us on the webinars that we're doing this week. You can find out more about it at triggercharts.com/events, or just go to triggercharts.com and check it out. And you can go over to The Disciplined Investor. There'll be lots of information there as well. And you can even sign up for a daily recap of the things that happen on The Disciplined Investor, the things we talk about, et cetera, on there, and get, for example, some of the stocks to watch, the economic reports. They'll come right to you the next day. You won't get it live, but you'll get it within 24 hours or, you know, even less of when we actually post it. So you can go to the site on the top right. There's a little place to put in your email and your name, and you'll automatically be added to the list. So thanks for joining me, and I'll see you real soon.
The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contains forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations, and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor, regulated in various states. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.